WVOX and WVOX.com, the official stations of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy, and it's Bolfamonte season, as we call it here in Westchester. For years and years around here, Mario Bolfamonte and his sons, Stephen, Anthony, and Benny, have been the royalty of the landscaping and outdoor maintenance world, and I don't exaggerate a bit. Their marvelous new headquarters near the New Rochelle Humane Society off Fifth Avenue and off Potter is not the easiest place in the world to find, I can tell you, but it's the place individual homeowners go on their own for advice on everything that grows. And it's also the place professional landscapers take their clients to select plantings. The Mario Bolfamonte and Sons Garden Center is a Westchester treasure, and it's the perfect time right now for a visit with your landscaper or on your own. Call 914-636-4428 and ask for Anthony, Stephen, Benny, or the great Mario Bolfamonte himself for directions. I'm reminded the place is actually a few steps from the new Gundelax power equipment location, and it's only a few blocks from the radio station where I'm talking to you from right now. It's Mario Bolfamonte time again in the land, I tell you.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity. We do have a flash flood watch in effect right through this afternoon. Our high temperatures for today are expected to average generally about the middle 70s. We do have the chance of some showers and thunderstorms, and the showers and thunderstorms this morning will taper off mid to late morning hours. It's during the afternoon that we get into that clearing trend. At our high temperatures, mid 70s, another round of showers and thunderstorms, though, are likely in the afternoon and evening. And overnight tonight, it does clear up. Overnight lows in the mid-60s. Mostly sunny on Friday. Friday's highs middle to upper 80s. Fair skies at night in the upper 60s. Saturday, back to partial sun. Clouding up in the afternoon with a chance of some showers and thunderstorms. Again, middle to upper 80s on Saturday. Sunday's weather's looking mostly cloudy. Again, the chance of some showers and thunderstorms. Our high temperatures middle to upper 80s. Monday, a little bit less likely as far as showers are concerned, but it will be partly sunny. And our highs will reach the middle 80s. Nice weather for Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. Mid-80s each day. I'm meteorologist Heath Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents Environmentally Sound with environmental activist Bob Lebensold. Join Bob and his guests as they talk about protecting our most precious resource, the environment. Now, here's Bob Lebensold.
Thank you very much and good morning. Welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2008, the 35th day of summer. We have lost 1 minute of daylight since yesterday, 20 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. The sun rose at 5:44 this morning. It will set at 8:19 this evening. We will have 14 hours and 35 minutes of daylight today. That is 33 minutes shorter than the longest day of the year and counting. The moon will rise at 11:16. It will set at 12:22 tomorrow afternoon. We are 1 day short of last quarter, and the next full moon is on August 16th. Did not get a chance to check the tides this morning, but I assure you they will rise twice and ebb twice today. Now, our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. 19 service members died in June. That's an old statistic. To date, there have been 4,124 American deaths, among a total of 4,438 coalition deaths. Tens of thousands more with grave physical and or mental injuries. Casualties this week are Tech Sergeant Jackie L. Larson, age 37, of Tacoma, Washington. He actually died of natural causes, whatever that means, in a war zone on July 17th. Staff Sergeant David W. Textor, 27. He was a Special Forces troop. He's from Roanoke, Virginia. He died on July 15th of an incident in his vehicle. Staff Sergeant Jeremy D. Vrooman, age 28, from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, died on the 15th of a homemade bomb during combat operations in Canaan, Iraq. Aviation bosun mate, Petty Officer 3rd Class Daniel R. Verbecki, age 25, assigned to aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt. He's from Exton, Pennsylvania. He actually died on July 14th of complications of a flight deck accident suffered in December of 2005. So he's been laid up for 2.5 years, and he finally died, unfortunately. Staff Sergeant Danny P. Dupre, age 28. He was a Marine from Lockport, Louisiana. Good French name from Louisiana, probably a cultural Cajun. Died on July 15th, combat operations in Anbar Province. Lance Corporal Jeffrey S. Stevenson, age 20, of the Marines from Newton, New Jersey. Died on the 13th of July of a non-hostile incident. Again, I never am sure. If you're in a war zone and you're a young person, how do you die of these things? Sergeant First Class Stephen J. Chevalier, age 35. He was in the 101 Airborne Division from Flint, Michigan. He died on the 9th of July. His vehicle was struck by a grenade. Sergeant Chevalier was killed the day before our last broadcast. All the others were still alive at our last broadcast. How many more American servicemen who are alive today will be gone when next we meet? Each life is a treasure and a tragic loss to each of us. May these American servicemen live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, time for the Culture Corner. My reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Well, I saw The Dark Knight, which is the Batman movie, which is making all the noise and breaking all the records. When I started watching this movie, I was really taken with it. Christian Bale was masterfully dark as Batman. He was above the comic book character, human, but really superhuman at that. He could not fly like Superman, who has that alien ability, but his devices served him almost as well. When the Joker appeared, I really sat up and took notice. Heath Ledger played the role masterfully. He evoked Javier Bardem, this year's Oscar winner for No Country for Old Men, and that is high praise. Ledger plays the viscerally evil character with such skill that, like Bardem, one has to wonder about the depths of the darkness within him from which he drew such inspiration. Unfortunately, we are not destined to see him develop as an actor beyond this point, for, as you probably know, Heath Ledger died of an overdose of sleeping pills 2.5 months shy of his 29th birthday earlier this year. I guess the darkness in him that allowed him to play this role was deep indeed. He leaves a substantial body of work and one not yet released movie called The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, scheduled for a 2009 release. As for the movie, it started out good. I was tempted to give it 3.5 stars halfway through, but then, alas, director Christopher Nolan fell into the trap of not knowing how or when to end a movie. It happens far too frequently. like a politician who promises everything to everyone, he tried to please everyone and fell flat doing so. There was probably a half hour, at least, of excessive, unnecessary mayhem. Yes, Batman is a good fighter. Yes, cars go boom and explode into flames when they roll over. We get that. If you wish to make an intelligent movie and pander to cutthroat tastes, start by giving them just enough violence and mayhem and leave time for a crisp, smart plot. What's so hard about that formula? Unfortunately, this movie's plot, while present, gets buried in all the over-the-top action. And lest you suppose this reviewer doesn't care for action films, wrong. I'm a big Bruce Willis and action movie fan. Still, Heath Ledger is the best Joker I've seen, and that includes Jack Nicholson, and Christian Bale tops Adam West, Val Kilmer, and Michael Keaton as Batman, in this reviewer's opinion. The cinematography is great, except when Nolan gets caught up in his chase and destruction loops, and Maggie Gyllenhaal isn't too hard to watch, and she even acts a bit. So I have to give it 3 stars because it has some really good stuff, and I recommend it to people who like action and enjoy good acting. My guess is that Heath Ledger will get a well-deserved post-mortem Oscar nomination. Just a quick station ID. You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 coming out of New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Aberdeen, Baltimore, or New Carrollton, Maryland, or Aberdeen City in the UK, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. This program is Environmentally Sound. I am your host, Bob Lebensold, and my guest today, my only guest today, is Walter Isaacson. He was formerly he is now president and CEO of the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado. Walter was chairman and CEO of CNN, managing editor of Time magazine. He has authored 3 biographies of Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger, and now Albert Einstein. It was just released in paperback on May 13th. It was released last year in hardcover. Born in my favorite American city, New Orleans, and currently living in Washington, D.C., speaking to us from Aspen, Colorado, welcome, Walter Isaacson.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. And you make me sound peripatetic, but let me say that I lived in Westchester for many years.
Did you? In which of our communities?
Yonkers, Bronxville area.
Really? No, I had no idea. And your bio doesn't say anything about that.
Well, when I was working at Time magazine, I was commuting in on Metro North.
As we all do from time to time. So you actually spend time in Aspen, but your bio also says that you live in Washington, D.C. How does that work out?
The Aspen Institute's headquartered in Washington, but we do our summer meetings and programs out in our campus here in Aspen.
So you spend much of the summer out there?
Yeah, June, July, and August. It's a good time to be away from Washington.
I would imagine so. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, it's always a good time to be away from Washington. But does your wife and daughter come out there with you?
Yep, they're all here puttering around. In fact, we have the Dalai Lama, of all people, coming in today to Aspen, to the Aspen Institute for a 3-day event about Tibetan art and culture.
Well, you scooped me. I was going to make a deal about that. I was going to say you're on Environmentally Sound and you have the Dalai Lama on the same day. What a good day you're having.
Well, it's good to be with you in particular.
Well, thank you. That's gracious. How's the weather out there in Aspen? We have a rainy one here.
There are no clouds in the sky. It's a deep blue, and it feels like it's about in the mid-60s.
Well, a little cool, but sounds like
it'll warm up a bit.
It will, yeah. Midday. Now, just a little more background on you. You attended Harvard College. You are a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. You worked in England with the London Sunday Times. Then you came back home to work for the very well-known, prestigious Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Quite an odyssey. Now, let me ask you this. Was all this planned, or have you allowed the fates to play a part in your life?
I think the fates always play a part in our lives, and certainly in mine. I studied everything from history and literature and economics when I was in college and didn't quite know what I was going to do with it. But I went back to New Orleans, joined the Times-Picayune, and then was recruited for Time magazine.
See, I'm so glad to hear that, because a lot of times people ask me, how did you get where you are? And even when I sing My Way, it says, I planned each charted course. I can't sing it like that because I never planned a thing in my life. I just bounced around. So I'm glad to hear that I have some good company.
Well, right. It's always good to go where the currents take you.
Yeah. Now, you are vice chairman of the Louisiana Recovery Authority after Hurricane Katrina. What happened there? What don't we know about that whole business? You know, the government did not do what it was supposed to do, and you were actually I don't know if the Louisiana Recovery Authority was part of the of government. What is all that? What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, we were formed about a month after the storm, because what happened is there was a massive breakdown at every level of government when the storm hit the city. The levees that were built were substandard, and they failed, and so it flooded the city. As the city was flooding, the governor, the mayor, the president, the head of FEMA were all pointing fingers, but nobody was helping people get out. And it's taken a while, but now the city is rebuilding quite well. And it's, you know, I go down there often. I love New Orleans. And it's actually, most of it is a totally thriving city now, because the spirit of the people is so good, the creativity and the imagination of those people so wonderful.
Well, New Orleans is, as I said, it's my favorite American city, and that's probably because it has such spirit. I mean,
and such creativity and such imagination. I mean, I can't wait for you to get down there. You'll be so amazed at how that city bounced back.
Well, I'm going to have to. I haven't been there since Katrina, but I've been there a number of times, and I was always taken the way they keep the Garden District, and of course,
Bridgewater.
Of course, beg your pardon?
Yeah, the Garden District and the French Quarter. And
The French Quarter is it's otherworldly. You can.
Well, the good news about the storm is that it did not flood the older areas of town. Of course, you know, 200 years ago when they built the French Quarter and the Garden District, people weren't crazy. They built as high as they could above sea level. And so those areas of town are above sea level. And I think what some people don't understand about Katrina is that there was devastation for wide parts of the city, including my family home was under 8 feet of water.
Ouch.
But there were part of, you know, the Garden District, French Quarter, Tulane University did not really flood. And so they came back strong very quickly.
Okay, but all the service personnel lived in those low-lying areas, so there was no one to man the city.
Oh, no, and we had to bring people back to the city. We had to make sure everybody felt they could come home. And that took a long time to rebuild the parts of the city so that everybody could feel they could come home.
So would you say that the Louisiana Recovery Authority was successful?
We had some glitches in what we tried to do, but we were honest. And one of the things that you worry about in Louisiana, you're sending $12 billion of money for reconstruction, that there's going to be fraud or corruption. And we had two accounting firms look at every penny that came down there. So there was no fraud and corruption, but I think it happened too slowly. If I may, be self-critical of our group, we were too careful about the spending of the money, and it made people have to wait 6-8 months longer than needed for them to come home.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad somebody was down there being honest, because the government, the federal government certainly wasn't, and I don't know, can't say so much about the local governments. And of course, I'm biased, so biased against this administration in Washington that I'll throw anything I can at them. Let's go to Einstein. This is a great book. It's a big, fat 600-page book, but it's chock full with stuff. I mean, what an undertaking! And before I do, you've written three major biographies: Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger, and now Albert Einstein. How does it puzzles me? How does Kissinger fit into that bunch? You have two people that time will never forget, and then a guy who probably most people have already forgotten. Why did you pick Henry Kissinger?
I did a book with a friend of mine called The Wise Men, which is about American foreign policy after World War II, and how we had bonded together based on shared values to create a foreign policy that had things like the Marshall Plan that was the best about our nation, or the World Bank and other institutions that were trying to win a struggle in this world to help people economically, to provide safety around the world. And it didn't work perfectly, but these were very creative people. It all comes a cropper in Vietnam. And I wanted to write about the Vietnam era, and I wanted to write about American values and foreign policy. And I think Kissinger was a very brilliant man, but where I think he failed was understanding the ideals of democracy and the values of America have to be part of its foreign policy. And so that was the theme of that book. But also I was looking at creativity. Certainly when I finished doing Kissinger, I said, I'm never going to do anybody alive again. That was too much trauma. So I went back and did Benjamin Franklin and then Albert Einstein.
Well, was Kissinger the best person to write a biography about so that you could backdrop Vietnam and all of that stuff? I mean, if you wanted to talk about the world at that time and you needed a figure to bring it together, I still don't know why Henry, although...
Well, he was the one who was a creative thinker, for better or worse, in our foreign policy, opening up with Nixon to China, balancing China against Russia, dealing with the Vietnam War. And it was a period of great turmoil that was the opposite of the wise men period, where you had people from both parties coming together for a nonpartisan foreign policy. So I wanted to write about both brilliance, but also about values and how they connect.
And the fact that he was alive at the time, is he still alive? I don't even know.
Yes, definitely.
The fact
The
fact that he was alive, how did that complicate things, and did he like the book?
No, he did not like the book.
He pulled his pants down, I bet.
he made it very clear he didn't like the book, but he was very cooperative when I was writing the book, gave me quite a few interviews, and I think that, you know, the theme of the book about American values and how they have to be part of foreign policy, I think he, you know, objected to the way I looked at his approach to foreign policy. That said, you know, he is, I've talked to him quite a bit since then. I think he's reconciled to it. And at one point he called me up and said, well, even the 30 years war had to end at some point. So I've reconciled myself to your book.
Good, good. So you're cordial, at least, if not friendly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I disagree with you on this point. I actually respect Henry Kissinger's mind, his creativity in foreign policy, and even though I think that the foreign policy during the Vietnam era was deeply flawed because it didn't have enough of a component of a openness for American democracy and its values, I thought that there was both good and mistakes that had to be described in that era.
Okay, no, I wouldn't necessarily disagree because I don't have strong feelings. I just kind of have an impression about Kissinger that he was part of an administration that was, corrupt, I guess you could say, but it almost loses its...
Well, I will say that after I finished and after his reaction, I said, okay, next time I'm going to write about somebody who's been dead for 200 years. So I moved on to Benjamin Franklin, who, by the way, was a person who balanced perfectly the notion of American values and America's interests when he was a statesman.
Ben Franklin. Well, yes. And so much more. I mean, he was
absolutely great.
Bon vivant. He was
inventor.
Scientist, inventor. He was great with the ladies, as was Albert Einstein.
Yeah, I know my wife always wonders why I write about people who are great with the ladies, but, you know, they were very creative, talented people, Einstein and Franklin.
Well, let's start with Einstein. We have a minute or so before the break, and then we'll get more into it after the break. But let's just start with him. He did not speak early, and apparently he was observing the world and looking at things from through the eyes of a slightly older child. That usually by that age, kids. Have gone past these simple observations. So when his father gave him a compass, for instance, at age 5, he was ready to receive that because he wasn't yet speaking, something like that, right?
Well, you know, the good news for those of us who are parents is that Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid. He was very slow in learning how to speak, as you said. And that allowed him to visualize things. He didn't think in words. He thought in pictures. And, for example, when his dad gives him that compass you talked about, he sits there day after day trying to visualize how a force field would work and make the needle of the compass twitch north. Now, you and I probably remember getting a compass when we were, you know, 6 years old, and we think, wow, look, it points north. And, you know, we go outside, but then a few minutes later, we find something else that, you know, look, there's a dead squirrel or something. So we're off on something else. But Einstein, for the rest of his life, is trying to think in pictures about what a force field would look like. And that's the point of my book, was that the science is not hard. The science is beautiful and creative, and you have to picture it, and that's what Einstein could do.
Yeah, I remember being fascinated by magnets more than.
Well, don't forget, that's all a compass is.
Of course,
it's a magnetic needle that twitches with the electromagnetic field of the Earth.
Yeah, my aunt had a pair of of little Scotty dogs that were magnetized, and she'd put one on top of the table and the other under the table, unbeknownst to me, and she would wave her hands, and this dog would walk around on top of the table, and that was what fascinated me.
It was the same electromagnetic field, but you probably didn't try to picture it the way he did.
No, I probably didn't. I cannot claim to be quite on his level. We're going to take a break, Walter. Bear with us for about 5 or 6 minutes, and we'll come back and we'll talk for the rest of the hour about Einstein, and perhaps we'll touch Ben Franklin and certainly the Aspen Institute. Okay, we will be right. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York, and we will be right back.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. South Texas continues to take a pounding.
Tropical storm Dolly is weakening but still dumping incredible amounts of rain over South Texas. Flooding, strong winds, and the risk for tornadoes will continue throughout the day today.
Fox meteorologist Janice Dean. Barack Obama in Germany for a much-hyped speech today in front of Berlin's Victory Column.
It's the place where JFK said,
Ich bin ein Millionär.
But Barack Obama's more Ich bin ein Beginner, and some Germans believe the history-maker-style speech oversteps.
Fox News Radio's Alistair Wanklin, and some political advice for John McCain.
This is not a campaign that McCain can win if he plays it conventionally.
University of Virginia political science professor Larry Sabato recommending bold moves. He says McCain should throw the dice. Existing home sales falling 2.6% in June, twice the expected decline. Fox News, we report, you decide.
There's a brilliantly talented man on the east side of Manhattan, Sean Volkshuhr, the men's custom clothing stylist and haberdasher of great renown who presides over a very special men's shop called Zore. Zore has been likened to a 6,000-square-foot candy store for men who like to dress well, but not pay outrageous Madison Avenue designer prices. At Zore on East 54th Street, you'll find the in-town source you've been looking for, featuring bespoke tailoring, truly custom-made at eminently sensible, very reasonable prices. Zore is a perfect venue for the genius of Maestro Sean, who specializes in men's suits, shirts, and jackets in the Napolitano style with old-fashioned Italian sophistication. He also carries the latest from Etro, Terry Moonglare, and Haupt from Germany. But go there for bespoke custom tailoring at reasonable, sensible prices interpreted by a men's stylist who's not the least bit price hungry. Rather, a man who just loves to do what he does so well. Sean at Zore. It's next to the famous Vong restaurant on 54th, a few steps from the Lipstick Building in 3rd Avenue. Movie stars, bankers, and ball players know about Zore, the candy store for men. You'll love it. The style and the prices. East 54th off 3rd. Or call the talented Sean direct at 212-308-2090. 308-2090. 212 area code. Open Monday through Saturday, 11 to 8.
The official car service of WVOX and WVIP is Red Oak Transportation, the true distinction of riding in style and elegance. Based in White Plains, Red Oak Transportation is now the first choice of corporate CEOs and business executives in the New York metro area who rely on this premier car service for on-time, prompt pickup. And you can rely on it too. Red Oak Transportation, family owned and operated for 3 generations by the Stoppelman family. We invite you to find out why so many discerning travelers now use Red Oak Transportation to the airport, a trip to Manhattan, or for any special occasion. Red Oak Transportation features a full fleet of new town cars, SUVs, vans, and stretch limousines. When you want to ride in style and elegance, call Red Oak Transportation at 914-694-2222. 694-2222. 22 in Westchester, 914-694-2222. Red Oak Transportation, the professionals who go the extra mile.
This is John Fix III of Cornell's True Value Hardware in Eastchester, New York.
Here's the updated weather forecast.
You've heard me
West
talk
East
about
County
our family hardware store and how we've been helping our customers and neighbors
hours.
Take
More
care of their
Blake
homes for nearly 100 years. Well, now I'd like to tell you about our fun line of beverages. That's right, beverages. We've got four delicious flavors. Vanilla Cream Soda features a photo of our store in Tuckahoe, circa 1930. Next Generation Root Beer features artwork by Megan Fix, the fourth generation of Fix family members to join the hardware business. Big Box Orange Soda features an exciting action scene of customers scrambling to evade a forklift. And last but not least, John Jr.'s Lemonade, a thirst-quenching recipe personally endorsed by my dad. Stop in and ask him to autograph a bottle for you, and check out our cooler full of custom soda near the front of the store next time you visit. Cornell's True Value is in Eastchester between Scarsdale and Bronxville on Route 22, the White Plains Post Road. Cornell's True Value Hardware, serving Westchester homeowners since 1909 and quenching their thirst since 2003.
For the afternoon, a few sunny times, and again, the chance of a gusty thunderstorm. Some heavy downpours are possible with those this afternoon. Highs today, mid-70s. For tonight, mostly cloudy. Some showers and thunderstorms in the evening. Overnight, low temperatures, mid-60s, but it does clear up overnight. Mostly sunny on Friday. Friday's highs in the upper 80s. Fair at night, upper 60s. Saturday, partial sunshine. High temperatures for the day. It rains in the mid to upper 80s. Chance of a shower, thunder shower, afternoon or at night on Saturday. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to celebrating our environment. This is Environmentally Sound with environmental activist Bob Levensold on 1460 WVOX. Once again, here's Bob Levensold.
Thank you very much. We are back. You are listening to AM 1460 WVOX in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Providence, Rhode Island, New London, or Old Saybrook, Connecticut, Boston, or Athol, Massachusetts, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. This program is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold, and my guest today is the very accomplished Walter Isaacson. Welcome back, Walter.
It's good to be back with you.
It's wonderful to have you. We're talking about Einstein, and another aspect of his life was his a great connection for him with the world and his spiritual connection was his music. He was a violinist. Just how good was he?
He was very good. He learned to play violin as a child, just as his dad gave him a compass. His mother had given him a violin when he was a young kid. And whenever he tried to deal with the scientific theory that was giving him trouble, he would pace around and play Mozart. He said Mozart, it felt to him like Mozart had plucked his music from the harmony of the spheres, and Einstein was trying to do that with the scientific theories.
Could he have been a concert musician had he gone in that direction? Was he that good?
No, he was not that good.
Okay, but he was better than Jack Benny, probably.
Yeah, better than me and you, too.
Now, he famously declared that curiosity was the most important thing, more important than intelligence to the creative mind. He was obviously both. He made a big deal about curiosity, and you, of course, make that very clear. From his earliest days when he wasn't speaking and he was just looking in pictures, what do you have to say about that part of his personality?
Well, I think that he had a passionate curiosity in which he questioned things that you and I would find mundane, like why does the compass needle point north? Or what would it be like to ride alongside a lightning? Some of his greatest theories come just from questioning things like, how do we know that time passes the same for me as it does for you if you're in motion? Or if I saw two events being simultaneous, but you were moving on a fast-moving train, would they seem simultaneous to you? So he gets to these great creative leaps, the fact that time slows down if you're moving real fast, the theory of special relativity. Or he says, imagine being in an elevator car, deep in outer space where there's no gravity, but it's accelerating upward real fast. Would feel the same as gravity. You'd feel like you were in a gravitational field. And so he says there's an equivalence between gravity and acceleration. If from that, he comes up with a whole new theory of the universe. So it was those type of creative leaps that he made, leaps of the imagination, leaps of curiosity, not crunching, you know, data and coming up with scientific formulas.
Well, now, he had, in 1905 was his big year. He had those four big papers. There are two relativities. There's special relativity, and then he pondered and tortured himself to come up with a general relativity, which, as I recall, had to do with astronomical factors. Can you, now you do it very well in the book. You made me understand simply by translating what Einstein said, which is what a good author does. They just take something complex and make it readable. What I got was that lightning said to strike simultaneously to the Earth does not look simultaneously to someone who's standing closer to one than to the other, and certainly doesn't to someone who's on a moving train between these two spots.
He does a thought experiment.
Yeah.
It is very simple. He says, suppose lightning strikes both ends of a fast-moving train. And there's a guy on the platform halfway between the two strikes, and he's just standing there on the platform. And he sees the two lightning strikes as being simultaneous because the light from each of the strikes gets to him at the exact same moment. He said, boom, they happened at the same time.
Right.
But imagine there's a woman in the train. She's also halfway, you know, in the midpoint of the train. But she's moving forward really, really fast. It's a thought experiment.
Yeah.
And she says, oh, no, the one in front happened first, because she's a little bit closer. By the time the light from the strikes gets there, she's moved forward just a tiny bit. She says, the one in front happened first. Einstein's theory of relativity, special relativity, simply says that neither one of them is right, neither one of them is wrong. The guy on the platform can't say, I'm right because I'm standing still. None of us are standing still. The Earth is moving, it's spinning, the solar system is wandering around our galaxy, the galaxy is wandering around the cosmos. We're all in motion. We're all just in motion relative to one another. And so the woman on the train and the guy on the platform are both correct. One of them says the strikes were simultaneous. The other says they weren't. You can't say one of them is wrong. You just have to say what is simultaneous is relative, depending on your state of motion. That's all the theory of special relativity says. But from that, you get the fact that time is relative, depending on your state of motion. And for if you're moving really fast, trying to catch up with a light wave, the light wave will always travel at the same speed, but time will slow down.
You see, nobody can possibly understand that. When light is measured, no matter from where, whether you're traveling with it, whether you're traveling as fast as it, whether you're traveling away from it, it's always 186,000 miles a second, isn't that so?
Yeah.
How can you possibly
tell us that the speed of light, a light wave, will always travel at that speed, no matter whether you're going with it or against it, whether you're heading towards the train headlight or away from the train headlight?
So that's impossible to understand, right?
Well, not really, because if you do the great imaginative leap that Einstein did, now he was 17 years old. I told you, he thought in picture experiments, in his head, he imagines, what would it be like to ride alongside a light wave? How would I see the wave? Would it ever seem stationary to me? And what he comes up with finally is, no, the wave is always going to travel at the same speed, but time will slow down for me as I get near the speed of light.
So time slows down.
Time is relative, depending on your state of motion. And if you travel near the speed of light, time will travel more slowly relative to somebody who's not traveling.
But the speed of light is still measurable at exactly, well, not exactly, but very close to 186,000 miles a second.
Correct.
See,
and that light wave will always zip away from you at that speed, but time will slow down.
Even if
it's not intuitive, but that's why he's Einstein and you and I aren't. It's not intuitive, but we can picture it.
I can't.
We can say, oh, I get it.
No,
yeah,
if I'm traveling at 186,000 miles a second alongside a light wave, I expect to see, as you say in the book, a wave that is standing still. It's oscillating, I guess, vertically, but it appears to be standing still. But it's not that way.
Nope, it's definitely not that way.
I can't understand that, Walter. I'm sorry.
Well, just imagine that, you know, Newton told us no matter how you're moving, time is always the same. It tick-tocks all the same, you know, second by second. And Einstein says, how do we know that? That's not true. And Einstein turns out to be right. Time is different depending on how you're moving.
Well, also Newton hedged his bet there. He started bringing God into it. I have the quote here somewhere.
That it's the eye of God that sees the passage of time.
Yeah, he said...
Einstein believed in God as well, and he believed that God was a great creator of the laws of the universe. And Einstein used to ask himself, if I'm looking at how a theory is constructed, I ask myself, is that the way God would have constructed the universe?
All right, well, Newton says, the deity endures forever and is everywhere present. He constitutes duration and space. And Einstein also said, I am devoutly unreligious, or I'm a very devout non-believer. I forget exactly how you put it.
Yeah, but he believed in sort of a what we would call a deistic notion of God. He didn't believe in a personal God who would sort of intervene in our lives. But he said once when they asked him that there's a spirit manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit in the face of which we must be humbled and awed. And to me, that's my sense of God. That's my sense of cosmic religion.
Well, the way you also put it, I guess you're just quoting him, for some, miracles serve as evidence of God's existence, but for Einstein, it was the absence of miracles, that the cosmos follows laws is worthy of awe, and laws that are discoverable, and once you understand them, you see how consistent and how they apply.
Yeah, he said, when somebody said, well, in simple ways, do you or do you not believe in God? He said, I believe in Spinoza's God, a God whose spirit is manifest in the harmonies of the universe. So it was that sense of the laws of the universe being so harmonious that gave him a sense of reverence. He said that, people sometimes say miracles are evidence of God's existence. For him, it was the absence of miracles that was the evidence of God's existence. The fact that there was harmony in all of the laws was evidence.
Okay, now we have to jump to quantum mechanics here. Einstein agreed with Spinoza that all things are determined by the necessity of divine nature, even when quantum mechanics seemed to show it was wrong. And he had a big problem, as do physicists today, treating things like light as waves and also particles. And Einstein actually created the quantum theory, didn't he?
Yeah, Einstein, back in 1905, when he couldn't get a job in a university, working as a patent clerk, comes up with relativity, the thing I mentioned about time being relative depending on your state of motion. And that very same year, 1905, he comes up with what we call quantum theory, that light is both wave and particle. And for Einstein, there was something unsettling about that, because it leads to what we now call the uncertainty principle. Heisenberg enunciated that, which is that you can never be certain of the exact position or momentum of a particular particle, that certain things happen by chance, and pure randomness at the subatomic level. And Einstein just didn't feel comfortable with that because, as you said, he believed in the harmonies of the laws of the universe. So one of his famous lines that he uttered over and over again was, I cannot believe that God would play dice with the universe.
Right.
That was his way of saying, I can't believe that there's uncertainty and chance at the subatomic level.
All right. Well, when he came up with this quantum thing, which does, to my elementary mind in physics, it does seem to allow for both particles and waves, in that the wave it's not continuous, but it's rather in very many almost molecular structures called quanta.
We call them photons today.
Photons, right.
Particles of light.
Right.
And light, you can be looked at either way, as if it were a wave or as if it were a stream of particles. And that leads to an uncertainty in things that is now inherent in quantum mechanics. But to the very end of his life, Einstein is trying to get a unified field theory that will tie together all the forces of nature and will somehow overcome that uncertainty you see in quantum mechanics. Just like the little kid looking at the compass needle and trying to understand the electromagnetic field, Einstein wanted a field theory that would apply to all the forces of the universe. And this is why he's so stubborn at the end of his life. He had been rebellious at the beginning of his scientific career, sort of questioning the notion of time and everything else. But by the end of his career, he's become a defender of classical physics and says he wants to overcome this randomness and chance and uncertainty that's at the core of quantum
theory. And to me, this is not a scientific thing, because I'm writing a biography. I'm not doing a book on the science. There's some other great books you should read about if you want to know the pure science. To me, what's interesting is, why do people, when they become older, become a little bit more stubborn, a little bit more set in their ways, a little bit more defending of the classical order of things and saying that they can't rebel? And, you know, Einstein used to say, God punished me for my contempt for authority by turning me into an authority myself.
Right.
And so his defiance of authority, his rebelliousness that he felt as a young man, by the time he becomes an older icon of science, he loses that rebelliousness.
Yeah, I forget exactly the context, but someone asked him a question, and that's when he responded, because the guy, it was kind of a gotcha question. The guy asked him a good question.
Yeah, the guy said, you know, when you were young, you always used to question authority. Why is it that you're so defending the classical order now? And he said, the good Lord is punishing me for my contempt for authority as a young man. He's turning me into an authority myself.
So now the string theorists, let's just do this very briefly.
Like Brian Greene, yeah.
Yeah, now they're trying to tie all this up using strings, but I try to listen to them and try to understand. It seems to me that creating strings is an awfully tenuous theory. Do you have any thoughts about that? I know you're not a scientist.
Well, I love the beauty, the elegance of string theory. And if you ever want to read about it, read Brian Greene's The Elegant Universe. And what it does is what Einstein was trying to do on his deathbed, which is try to find the mathematical equations that will tie together all of the forces of the cosmos. I'm not sure that string theorists have it right yet, and they're not sure they have it right yet. It's not testable yet.
Right.
So it's not even ready to be tested as a theory. But it is that quest that Einstein had for his entire life, ever since he held that little compass needle, and trying to find a way to describe the beautiful forces that hold together the universe.
You know, a couple of places in this book, you have a very charming style of writing. And in one place, we're talking about those scientists who are seeking the ether as an explanation, the ether being a medium through which light travels, just as waves in the ocean travel through water. And birds, let's say, travel through air.
Well, waves travel through air when you talk.
Sound
waves, yeah.
But in the vacuum of space, light still travels. So they were trying to postulate what they called the ether. And what you say there, that they considered everything, even that the Earth was the only thing in the universe at rest with the ether. Everything else was spinning around, the sun, the planets, the stars, and presumably poor Copernicus in his grave. I just wanted
well,
to...
Thank you. I like trying to make things fun or... amusing, because, that was it. By the time Einstein came along, people were so befuddled by this the nature of light that they were even beginning to consider that, well, maybe the Earth isn't moving and everything else is spinning around the Earth, just like Copernicus had disproven in the old days.
And spinning it. And there was another thing. When he, in his later years, when Einstein wanted to get photographs that could only be taken at a solar eclipse, and he was in touch with this Freundlich fellow, Freundlich was getting married, so they were going to come to wherever, Lake Como or someplace where they were going to meet, and you say that Freundlich's fiancée's reaction to spending part of her honeymoon with a theoretical physicist she had never met is lost to history. And
I try to make this a personal tale as well. And there's Einstein wanting to talk theoretical physics with some astronomer, and the poor guy's on his honeymoon. It's a bit of a funny scene.
Well, that's what made the book so readable, is you never knew when the Isaacson charm was going to jump out at you from all of this.
Oh, that's sweet of you to say.
Well, it's just absolutely so. I'm pondering, I'm cursing you when I'm trying to understand this... The theories of relativity, although I shouldn't curse you. You did a yeoman's job of making it clear, but my mind doesn't quite grasp.
But we all have to try to appreciate. My mind doesn't. I heard a violinist yesterday play a beautiful sonata by Ravel. My mind doesn't quite grasp why that piece was a sonata form. I tried to listen and understand, the mechanics of the music. But even though I couldn't understand each bit of the mechanics, I knew how beautiful the piece was. And so my book is just to tell you about a guy who's really interesting, and you should try to appreciate the beauty of his science. And I think people like me and you who aren't scientists, even if we can't get the deepest mathematics behind the science, we should still, you know, make that little bit of joy in the creativity and the beauty of science, because we're going to need that sense of scientific creativity and how important it is if we're going to be successful in this new century.
Yeah, well, I agree that you succeed in
and
space.
You're a great environmentalist, and to be a great environmentalist, you got to understand the beauty of nature. And the beauty of nature, the good Lord's equations are done scientifically.
Well, you don't really try to understand it. Walking in the woods, you just marvel at being part of it. I mean, just when I walk in the woods, some people walk in the woods and say, oh, God made a beautiful thing. I don't have that perspective. But when I hear even the borers in the wood, and of course the birds and the wind, every little sound, and to imagine the gift that I am part of it and that I can experience it, it's just
that was what motivated Einstein.
Well, I guess
walking in the woods and hearing the sound waves and understanding how light moves, to him, appreciating the beauty of the science was part of appreciating the beauty of nature.
Wow. I'm going to take just a minute, Walter, to tell everybody about my sponsors, The Learning Shop in Harrison, New York. They're a full-service tutoring company. They provide homebound services for upwards of 20 Westchester County school districts, including Bronxville, Rye, Edgemont, Chappaqua, and New Rochelle. And in addition, they provide private tutoring in all academic areas and for any number of standardized tests, GEDs, SATs, music. They've been running an after-school resource room program for over 7 years. The program runs 5 days a week from 3:30 to 5:30. These are great people. They're good friends of mine. There's always coffee and tea, either bagels and cream cheese or cookies. And I'm going to cut them a little short because I do want to just talk with Walter for this last couple of minutes. Walter, I knew this would happen. I knew I would have 20 questions and only get to about 5 or 6 of them. But let me just jump in. Was it not, in fact, fortuitous that Einstein could not get a job in academia and instead wound up at the patent office where he was on the forefront? He received ideas from the most creative minds seeking patents. He had a boss who supported him. He had plenty of time to do his own work because he was so good at it after the patent office work was done. And he had his friend Besso, who was a wonderful sounding board, and he had worked with his father and uncle on coils and magnetism. So isn't it really lucky that nobody snapped him up and made him a professor?
I think it was a godsend to Einstein that he didn't become a junior professor, having to teach the prevailing wisdoms and kiss up to senior professors at some university. There he is at the patent office with a boss who says, whenever you get a patent application, question every premise, challenge every assumption.
Assume everything's wrong, yeah.
And that's exactly what Einstein loved to do. And he's looking at patent applications, because he's in Switzerland, about how to synchronize clocks. The Swiss had just gone on standard time zones. And the Swiss, as you know, can be rather Swiss at times. They were kind of obsessive about making sure it struck 7 and or in the exact same instant that struck 7 in Zurich, for example. And there's Einstein saying, well, how do we know two events are at the exact same time? What if you're on a fast-moving train? Wouldn't it look differently? So that's where his theory of relativity comes from, is working in the patent office, looking at people who are using light signals, like radio signals or electric signals or light signals, to try to synchronize distant clocks. And so it's wonderful for him that he's sitting on that stool looking at patent applications rather than trying to teach the wisdom of Isaac Newton to young students.
I agree totally. Walter, I'm just so sorry. I wanted to talk about Einstein's brain and the Odyssey. It went on for 40 years after Einstein died, where the pathologist just removed it and just practically stole it. But we don't have time, unfortunately.
All righty. Well, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. And you enjoy the Dalai Lama, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. I would like to thank Walter Isaacson for making the time to visit with us today. Many people say they are busy. Walter Isaacson truly is, and it was a great gift of his time to spend it on WVOX this morning. You can always point to important people of the world, be they presidents, athletes, movie stars, authors, but how many geniuses can you name? They come along at their own schedule, perhaps provided by nature when they are needed. Albert Einstein was the most important scientist to come along in centuries. He stands among the very greatest, Sir Isaac Newton, Galileo Galilei. Walter Isaacson brings this man to life, a great physicist, no doubt, but also a sailor, classical violinist, humanitarian, man of many lovers and two wives, a man of great passion in everything he did. Surely his work could have been made stuffy by some authors, but not by him. Our thought for the week, it is tasteless to prolong life artificially. I have done my share. It is time for me to go. I will do it elegantly. I have to pass on some time, and it doesn't really matter when. Guess who said that? Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential radio station.
You've been listening to Environmentally Sound on 1460 WVOX. Environmentally Sound, hosted by environmental activist Bob Lebensold. Join Bob at 10 a.m. every other Thursday for Environmentally Sound on 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.